All right, what's up, guys? Zach Evanesh here, and perhaps the most epic interview about to go down. This one is going to be awesome for Underground Inner Circle, Underground Strength Nation. We've got Warrior Man on the line, and I'm beyond honored, man. I'm really grateful for your time to be on here. Thanks, Warrior.
Yeah, hey, Zach, it's my honor to do an interview with you. You know, I get solicited all the time to do all kinds of different interviews, and most of the time I turn them down because I'm not inspired by the interviewer in any way, and they want to talk about subjects that I'm already well beyond. So, yeah, thanks, man. It's my pleasure.
Awesome. So for everybody listening, if, you know, you're inside, obviously you've seen my blog posts and sharing videos of Warrior. Website is warrioruniversity.com. And you have a lot of sites or mini sites within there. Some really kick-ass stuff. The artwork that you do, very, very inspirational. And just every video. And so I just guess want to, you know, give people kind of like an inside look into how things came about to where you are today. And most people, like myself, first came across you seeing you wrestling on TV and being blown away by your intensity. And what I was thinking of was that I was saying to myself, I was like, that was not really even your character. That was really who you are, intense, always inspired, and just going balls to the wall with everything you do. Let's go back, I guess, and talk to us about your beginnings of training and how kind of everything evolved, taking you to some of the things we spoke about, owning a gym, going to school for chiropractic, being a pro wrestler, being perhaps, you know, one of the most popular pro wrestlers to ever walk inside a ring. So talk to us about, like, the earliest days. Like, how did you and who started you into training?
Well, I grew up in the Midwest in a small town of only 600 people, and I went to a school called Fountain Central High School, which was a consolidated school, and all the similar small towns in the area, everybody got on a bus and just went to the same school, and it was out in the middle, you know, just surrounded by cornfields and everything else. So I grew up in the Midwest, had a really great childhood. My dad left when I was 11 or 12 to never look back to provide any kind of support, financial or otherwise. That had a huge impact on me and is a great part of my story about who I am today and what I think about being a man and a father and all those different things. But I was, when I think about back to those times, I mean, we're going way back, and I mean, I had a couple buddies who lived way out in the boondocks. I mean, they didn't have indoor plumbing in their house. They had an outhouse, what they have. So we're going back, and we're talking about, you know, way out in the sticks. And there really wasn't a lot to get in trouble with. And it was just, you know, but I was a kid that had a reputation for being in the wrong place at the wrong time in whatever juvenile type of way you could, you know, mischievous way you could get in trouble back then. And we're just going to high school, just happy-go-lucky, had a couple buddies I hung out with and stuff. And I happened to stumble into the high school weight room one day, which was about, it was an 8x10 room that had one of those 13-14 circuit universal machines in it.
Yep.
And I'm standing there, there's one light bulb in the center of the room, and I'm standing there and I'm looking at my long skinny shadow, and all of a sudden it just gets overwhelmed by this huger shadow behind me. And I turned around and a big huge guy standing there was, I found out, one of the new football coaches. He's only 23, just got out of college, a guy by the name of Gary Pate. He looked at me, smiled this big huge smile, says, "What are you waiting for? Let's get started." And I didn't know him. I didn't know him then. He was new to the school and stuff, and I started hanging out there with the benches and doing the exercises he was doing, and I just got hooked on it, man. I got addicted. It wasn't long, because I was such a skinny kid, that I started noticing changes in my body, and other people did too. And I I don't know why at the time, but I thought to myself, well, if I can, I knew I was in control of those changes. And I said to myself, if I can control that, then I can create changes or make changes in my life otherwise. And it just turned my whole life around. I started thinking about going to college and setting higher goals for myself. And that was a lot different than the, you know, my mom was a really, really great woman, but she's a fatalist. She really believed in the idea that you're born into your lot in life and you should just be happy and satisfied with that and not really hope for much more. And my other brothers and sisters, I'm the oldest of five, they sort of picked up on that, except one of my brothers who later on, after many years in his 30s, ended up finding it within himself to go back to school, and he became like an aeronautical engineer or something like that. And that's how I got started with that, man. And I just became a big follower, studier, wanting to know more. Back then, I think you'll know better than I, the Muscle Builder, it was called, or Muscle and Power.
Yeah. They were both
the old Joe Weider magazine, and they used to have articles in there about how to kiss girls and all that stuff, man. I remember that.
Oh, they did. They really had, like, a lot of the stuff in there was, I still have, like, all the, like, the ads within those magazines.
Yeah.
Were all, like, dealt with you being able to pick up girls.
Yeah, funny stuff, man. And I was, of course, I was a big fan of Arnold because he was the guy at the time, his look, his just the vibrancy that came off of him is just, you know, like he wanted to just go out and conquer the world, and the way they wrote the articles and stuff like that, and just started finding my own way. And then I had a buddy by the name of Ryan, his older brother had a bench and some free weights, and we did that, and he was into it for a while, and it just, you know, I stuck with it. And my first year of college, I went to Indiana State University. I lived in the dorm, and they had a mess hall, and you had a meal card. And I had brothers and sisters. My mom was the only one raising us. We never went without anything. But I always remember being a little aggravated that, you know, there wouldn't be enough milk to go. You know, I wanted more milk. I wanted more peanut butter and jelly. I wanted those things because I knew to eat to get bigger. I was a skinny kid anyway. So I go to Indiana State University, and they had, when you went to the dining hall, you know, they had these big milk things where you just pull the handle, you get to drink as much as you want. I thought I was in heaven because of that. And then they had a weight room down in the basement of this place. And back then, you got to remember, back then, coaches and stuff weren't into athletes training with weights. They thought it was really going to screw up
their
athletic ability, their flexibility, their coordination, their, you know, own natural, their innate talents. In fact, there was a weightlifting class there taught by a guy named Mr. Jones. He was like 80 years old, but man, he could go down in that gym and he could grab those freaking weights and just, you know, while he's talking and instructing you, just move heavy shit around. And, but they thought he was a nutcase because he was talking about that, you know, weight training is good for athletes. And so they had this weight room that had, I was like a kid in a candy store, man. It was unreal. And I probably put on, I don't know, one of those typical stories that you hear about 30 or 40 pounds that year. I mean, I just got freaking big. And just continued with it, you know. I ended up going to Florida, go to college down there, ended up going to a regular public gym, and was fortunate enough then to meet up with a guy by the name of Jim Green, who was about 10 years older than I, but sort of took me under his wing. He was in his 30s or 40s. And I didn't know any other way at the time. You just worked out as hard as you could all the time. That was the way. All these different philosophies and theories that are around now, they weren't there then. You know, like I say, I mean, even the coaches and stuff weren't into allowing athletes to even get into exercising and training. So all this stuff that has happened over the years with training, it's all relatively new. The science that we now know and everything like that. But, I mean, I just was balls to the wall all the time. And it sort of fits into, and that's why I've been outspoken about overtraining in a general way. You know, different things work for different people, but I think so many people are focused on trying to figure out the exact science of what's going on that they they end up talking themselves out of what they need to do most. Get in the fucking gym and just start pushing heavy shit around. And so it always worked for me. I just always kept gaining weight. I always kept getting stronger. And it never really changed. And then I went to chiropractic school. I drove up from Florida to Atlanta, Georgia. I was in Marietta, Georgia, actually, and there was a school there called Life Chiropractic College at the time, and it was small at the time. Now it's Life University. It's a big, huge freaking place.
Yep.
And ironically, you know, chiropractic at the time attracted meatheads, you know, muscle heads, you know, guys who like to get into working out. And so I had a bunch of buddies. We were all into working out, probably more into working out than even going to class. And there was the gym called Kegel's Gym. It was the baddest-ass gym. It was just hardcore to the max. You know, guys would squat until they bled out of some orifice. I mean, you know, it was unreal. It was so inspiring. In the wintertime, the steam would come off the walls inside. And it was an old propane gas tank manufacturing place or something. And the guy who ran it, Charlie Thompson, I'll never forget him. And you don't forget these kind of people. It's just like he was never had a bad day. He was always on. And, you know, that can have such a huge effect in gyms when you walk in and, you know, the guys behind the counter are idiots or they're, you know, they're looking right through you or they're, you know, they're not interested in, you know, they're just not inspiring in any way. And then when you walked into this place, man, you were inspired to get jacked. And there were some jacked up dudes in there. And so I got really started getting big then and entered some bodybuilding contests in Georgia. There was a guy there by the name of Doc Neely, who was a big, huge promoter of national level contests, the Mr. America, Mr. USA. And he was with Jim Mannion, the other guy that's out there, worked really closely with him.
Jim Mannion, I think, still does all the...
Yeah, his boy does, too. Years ago when I was a wrestler, I did an interview with his son or something, and I crossed paths with it from there was a link to it somebody sent me or something. And
yeah.
What I was talking about then is a similar way as to how I, you know, still train today. And... So I got into the Mr. Georgia contest. This was 1984. I won that and then got into the Mr. America contest in 1984, the year that Mike Christian won it. Ed Connors, one of the original Gold's Gym owners of the three. There was Ed Pete Grimkowski, Tim Kimber, and Ed Connors. They were the three original owners of that Venice gym. Not the original one. That was Ken Sprague. Back in the old days, like those photos, you black and white pictures you're always putting up at your site and stuff. But Grimkowski, Kimber, and Connors came in. They bought it and they built it into the bigger place. And they were in. They just kept expanding in this place where they had. It just became really, really freaking huge. But Ed Connors contacted me after the Miss America 1984, and I was the heaviest guy in the contest. I mean, I was still young and needed to fill out even more, and but had great development, great potential. And he said, you know, every year me and Tim and Pete, we look at a couple guys nationally, and we ask them, approach them about coming out and spending some time training for a competition, and we cover all your expenses. And of course, if you win, you know, you say good things about Gold's Gym and everything else like that. So I went out and did that. I trained for the Junior Mr. USA, which was in Texas, and that Ron Love won it, a black guy.
I remember Ron Love.
Yeah, and
he was a cop in Texas.
Exactly. Yeah, he won that, and I was big as shit, but was getting advice and coaching from Tom Platz at the time. That's when Tom Platz was really huge. And Chris Dickerson was out there, and he was helping me out with different things. And that's when I did the Chris Lund, a famous bodybuilding photographer that's been around for years. That's when I did a photo shoot with him, and he did a lot of photo shoots with Dorian Yates. I did a photo shoot with him, and that's when they put my picture on the cover of that super high intensity.
I had that book. That was a
birthday. Yeah, I still got it, too.
That was a gift for me when I was on my 14th birthday.
Really? Yeah, that was
89.
Man, I tell you, I, you know, I'm 52 now. I would give a few years of my life to go back and relive those times, man.
Really?
They were the best. Oh, I would. Yeah, I just, and to young guys that are into weight training and wanting to pursue something athletically or be a bodybuilder or be a power lifter, man, I say go for it. Give it every freaking thing you got so that you don't regret one day that you didn't, man, because there's nothing like that in the world. I mean, I was close to 300 freaking pounds.
Really?
Yeah, and I was just, I mean, I was getting freaking big and went with Ed and sat and had breakfast with Joe Weider one day, and he said, "Let's see your forearms," or whatever his accent was, you know, and he just wanted to keep looking at my forearms and how jacked they were, and it was a funny time. And
do you
anyway, I did that contest, and yeah. I got fifth place, and for different reasons, I don't know, I didn't get my, you know, I held water, ate the wrong foods at the last minute. I mean, the way guys looked at it then was that, you know, you dieted hard, and getting ripped or your diet back then for a bodybuilder was you went tuna fish and water.
Yes.
there was none of this stuff like what they have today. Even
crazy.
You're probably aware of Dave Draper and
yeah,
his
Dave
side.
Draper
he talks
that.
About that all the time, the
I
tuna fish diet. It works. In 2 or 3 days, man, you it's an incredible you notice an incredible difference. And all this, you know, the foods and the chemicals and the processed foods that you can eat otherwise, it just it doesn't work as well. But anyway, I didn't time it right, held water. That's what I attributed it to. And I had to come out and live out in California. I had taken a quarter off from my chiropractic studies. And, of course, by that time in my schooling, I was towards the end of my academics. I finished my academic stuff only short a couple classes, and but after that I had to do all my clinical stuff. There was clinical requirements. They had a clinic there on campus, and you had to do that to actually get your doctorate degree. And by the time I got 3 to 4 years into my schooling, I mean, I wanted to be a bodybuilder. I wanted to be, you know, one of the, a pro bodybuilder is what I wanted to do. All my energies were really devoted to that. And I did that USA contest. I came back to Georgia, and it wasn't long after that that Ed called me and said, "There's a guy out here that's putting together some guys to be wrestlers, and or would you be interested?" So I had a couple conversations with the guy, and I decided that I was going to go for it. So I sold everything I had. Moved out to California. Within a couple weeks, man, me and the other guy, Sting, Steve Borden.
Yeah.
You know, he was one of the four guys. And he lived in California, though. He had his family there and everything else. He had a support system. I didn't have anything. I had only the money in my pocket. And so we had a house that all of us were living in. There were two other guys that really were just, they were half-assers. They weren't in it for the, you know, to do whatever it took to succeed in it. And I was basically, I was in a corner because I had only limited resources and was going to do everything I could to try to make it into the pro wrestling. But we knew nothing about the business. This guy that had this idea to take these four wrestlers, train them, and then put them into the business, he knew nothing about the business either. He thought that if he trained them and he just showed up down at a wrestling show that Vince McMahon was putting on, he could just go to his door and knock and say, "I got four guys that are ready to be wrestlers." And we didn't know otherwise either, but, you know, I was so into wanting to achieve something, using my physique or be a pro bodybuilder, the idea of going to California, training at Venice. I was young. I thought, man, I'm going to go for it. A couple weeks after I'm out there, man, we're starving. You know, we're in grocery store aisles, you know, in the middle of the night, eating the turkey out of the packages and the cheese out of the turkey and cheese to get nutrition, man. We got caught one night, and I remember running. I'll never forget, I had like a mouthful of Colby cheese. You know, we're scarfing it down because we don't want to get caught. And the guy, I see out of the corner of my eyes because we're looking out at our periphery, and I saw somebody peek around the corner. So I told Steve, I said, they were caught. They saw us, man. I saw the guy poke his head around. He's jerked it back real quick. He's, we got to get the fuck out of here. So our car, Steve's car, is the only car in the parking lot. So we start walking fast, and then we just start fucking hauling ass and running about halfway through the store, bowled out the front door, and, you know, I got a mouthful of this Colby cheese that's, you know, keeping me from breathing properly. So spitting out chunks, and Steve's doing the same thing. We're saying, don't go to the car. We'll come back and get it later. Ended up, you know, I'm like 300 pounds with a mouthful of Colby cheese coming through my nose and everything. Ran about a mile and kept looking back to see if somebody was coming. And they got the car and they started coming. And Steve went one way. I cut another way. And I ended up, for some reason, I didn't know where to go, and I'm panicking. So I hid behind this bush and in the dark by this house or this building or something. And here they come down this alley. We'd taken off running down an alley. So they come in their car real slow in the alley. They're looking for us. And here I am. I'm heaving like a, you know, like a dinosaur behind this bush. And they stopped and they saw me. They were probably about 50 feet away, but they stayed there for about 2 or 3 minutes looking at me. But I must have been such a scary sight, man. They just decided to go on. And I didn't know where we were. This is all new to me in California because we were picking different grocery stores all the time. And I just started walking. Eventually, I started walking and thought, I'll run into a crossroads or a main drag or something that I'll recognize. I'll get home. About 4 or 5 hours later, I ended up back at the house. Anyway, when it all fell apart with the guy, me and Steve, we started sending some flyers around. It was good that we were ignorant because, you know, what we were doing was kind of silly, but we put pictures of ourselves together, sent them around to a list of wrestling organizations. Back then, there were a bunch of them, small ones, you know, all over the country. And there always was, even before Vince actually took off, you know. I mean, a lot of the promoters back at that time, or going back years before I got in the business, you know, they criticized Vince because Vince's dad, who owned his promotion, the one Vince came to have, there was like an unspoken code that you didn't go into other people's territory. Well, when Vince came up with the idea to do the entertainment in a huge way, he says he went around and asked everybody, and he may have, if they wanted to get in on it. But everybody sort of snubbed him on it, turned their nose up at it. And so I said, well, I'm going to do it anyway. But there were a bunch of smaller territories, and we ended up in Tennessee at this Mid-Southern wrestling place. And I remember driving there. I'll never forget, me and Steve, we drove from California in his car. And, I mean, we thought that within a week or two we were going to be like millionaires. And we ended up. There, we ended up, I mean, we had to write back home to Ed Connors and see if he could give us some money so we could just live. And we ended up, Steve got hurt, so we had to take some time off. We ended up going down to Louisiana. I didn't get along with the promoter guy. He was a guy who liked to sort of, you know, because he was a promoter, push people around. And we were learning how to work, meaning we were learning how to, you know, carry out our fights and choreograph stuff in the ring. We were what you call green, and we didn't have that knowledge. And, in fact, when we went to Tennessee, when we got into town, we had a number to call. We called the number. We go to the promoter's house, big old huge place, and they take us into this dining room or something. It's got all this nice dining ware and china cabinets and stuff. And they said, lock up. You know, like two wrestlers when they walk into one another and,
right,
they, you know, lock up with one another. And so me and Steve did, but we were so green, we almost knocked each other out. And we also almost, if somebody wouldn't have caught it, we almost knocked over this big, huge china cabinet with all kinds of stuff in it. And one of the guys off to the side just started shaking his head and rolling his eyes. Like, oh, my freaking fucking God, man, you guys don't know what to do at all. But we were such nice guys, and we minded our manners, and we weren't full of ourselves. We respected the veterans, and they were very helpful. So we ended up through there and then down to Louisiana working for this promoter called Bill Watts, and he real a-hole, and he wanted me one time, and he liked to take the big guys, the big, strong, powerful guys, and if they were green, he liked to make examples of them in front of the other boys. So in the locker room one time, he wanted me to get down on all fours, my hands and knees, and he said, I'm going to show you how to kick somebody in the stomach, meaning that he was going to show me how to do it without really hurting them. But the reputation he had was that he would get green guys and do that, and then he'd try to kick the shit out of you. And I said, if you want me to get on all fours, you get me down there yourself, because I'm not going for it. And that created a real, you know, anger and bitterness with the other guys in the locker room and stuff like that. You know, they were surprised, because most guys in the business, you know, they'll do anything. You know, how far do you want me to bend over? You want me to bend over farther or what? And they don't have their own sense of self-respect to begin with. And so that made things a little bit more difficult. I ended up leaving there and going to Texas, and that's when I started the Dingo Warrior character. And had a good run there, became really good friends with the Von Erich kids, was there when Mike Von Erich, the youngest one, killed himself, committed suicide, was there when Chris, the youngest one, killed himself, became like a brother with Terry, and he had drug problems and stuff like that. And I was up at WWF before he even came up and did the Texas Tornado thing, but we just lived down the street from one another, and when I came home, we used to hang out. And, you know, just went on and had my career in that. And about the training, I mean, you know, when I got in the business and we got in it and we found out we weren't going to be millionaires and we, you know, survived the rough waters in the beginning, I didn't get in the business. And, you know, a lot of people are angry about this, but I'm not a second or third generation wrestler where my dad or my grandpa was in pro wrestling and I was just continuing a tradition. I got in it looking at it as a business. And when I got to a certain place and got through the initial rough stages of it, I stepped back and I looked at the business and said, how can I make me happen here? And I had all my bodybuilding knowledge, and I had an even deeper set of knowledge from my chiropractic schooling and the classes and everything that I took there. And I just put it to work, and I knew that, you know, the Road Warriors were one of the first guys, the muscle guys were coming into fashion. Me and Steve, from the beginning, we painted our face. And actually, we just had, like, black lipstick or something like that, and started that. And I just, you know, I thought through what I was doing. I started putting together a plan and starting becoming this character. And I was in Texas working down there, and it was going well enough. I mean, I was paying my rent and everything. But there's the guy who determines what wrestlers are going to wrestle with what wrestlers. That guy's called a booker. He's sort of the producer, the director of what kind of angles and soap opera stuff is going to happen between good guys and bad guys. And they were having difficulty holding on to a guy like that down in Texas. There was, you know, whoever was doing it was actually a wrestler, and that's not a good thing, because then they are prejudiced to who their character, and even if they're not the best character to be involved in angles to make money and sell tickets, they still go ahead and do it. And that was going on, but Fritz Von Erich, Kevin and Kerry, the Von Erich boys' father, who was the head honcho, the guy who had the final say, he had a good friend by the name of George Scott. And George Scott was this guy who worked with Vince in putting on the original WrestleManias. But after he got that started, he decided he was going to retire and he was going to go to Florida. And Fritz talked him into taking a detour, come to Texas and be the booker for a while and see if he could help him out. They were friends from you know, for years. And he came down there, and this guy in the office one day, after he'd been there for a couple months, this guy in the office named Bronco Lubick, really nice guy, old-time wrestler, he pulled me to the side, and he said, you know, he said, I heard George Scott on the phone today. He was talking to the head people up at WWF, and he was saying there's a kid down here that's got raw talent but could really be something great. And he says, I know they were talking about you. And not very long after that, I got a call from New York and got on the phone with Vince, and he's asking me what a dingo warrior is, you know. And I came up with the best explanation that I could. I got a call from them not long after that, and WWF was going to do a show in Tyler, Texas, which was one of the places where we went like every 2 or 3 weeks. And the Dingo Warrior character in the wrestling magazines, in the back they had the polls for popularity, you know, 1 through 10 and stuff. And Dingo Warrior was like number 2, just wrestling down in Texas, not even having the television exposure and everything else like WWF guys did, number 2 under Hulk Hogan. So we go to Tyler, Texas, and they put me in a match with somebody, I don't know, Macho Man was on the card, Tito Santana, all the other top guys from the time, and I go out to the ring, man, and the place went nuts, you know. And so after that, they called me and said, we want you to come out on the road and keep trying out or whatever, you know. And I didn't ask any questions, I was just, you know, wanted to get the opportunity. And so the first place they took me was Indianapolis, which is where I grew up. And, of course, people didn't know me that I was in wrestling or anything at the time because the WCCW down there in Texas, that didn't have widespread exposure. But, you know, when they do that, you know, wrestling is it's a rough business, man. It's, you know, you've got to have thick skin and you've got to have stamina. And or else you don't even get your chance. Nobody will ever find out about you. And so they put me in a match with this guy, Jose something. And we go to the ring, and I had been known for, you know, just grabbing guys and picking them up over my head, doing the gorilla press slam. So we get in the ring, and he had been instructed to see how much I had got in my tank. You know, let's see what this guy really got in his fucking tank. So we go out there, and every time I go to grab him, he says, press slam, press slam, press slam. So I'm like doing, you know, 100%, you know, I'm doing a maximum military press for like, you know, 15 times in a row. And eventually he stopped. And so I guess I survived the test, because when I came back through the curtain, there were guys there clapping and everything. And they let me continue with, you know, trying to make a way for myself. And I worked in the high schools. Back at the time, they ran 3 shows, the big stadium shows, the college shows, and then, like, high school places. I worked the high school places and stuff and did the yes or no stir, kept my nose clean, busted my ass, always kept a great attitude. And about 8 months later, I come to one of the television tapings that they did back at the time, and they said, it's time for you to go. And they put me in a room, and Vince was down there, and he said, we're not going to use the Dingo Warrior thing. I don't know what we're going to do, but let's just try something. So I did this, you know, in typical Ultimate Warrior fashion, like a locomotive, a train coming through a freaking wall. I said, I'm not this warrior. I'm not that warrior. I am the Ultimate Warrior. And Vince is off to the side. What'd he say? What'd he say? What'd he say? And that's what we went with.
Damn.
And that was the start of, you know, a great run.
So it's almost like if you're going to make it to the top of wrestling, it's almost like a baseball player who has to go through what they call the farm league. You just keep, you're like kind of like in the high schools and colleges until you show that you could play in the big leagues. Is that basically how they
Yeah, play? It is. I mean, of course, there are a bunch of factors that are figured in about things. But yeah, I mean, even if you've got great talent, like if you're a minor league baseball player playing in the farm leagues, I mean, they're looking at what kind of attitude you got, shit like that, you know. And that's I knew they were doing that. And but you know, specifically about my body, I just kept focusing on getting better.
Yeah,
you know, when I was younger, I mean, your body is different when you're younger, and you have a fullness that you, when in your youth, when you're into, you know, heavy training and stuff, that
yes.
is hard to keep as you get older.
Yep.
But there's something, you know, appealing, attractive, motivating, inspiring about what happens when you get older too, because your muscles become more dense.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's cool too. You know, as a guy who's an admirer of physiques and people who, you know, guys who train and weightlifters and stuff like that, you know that too. And I just concentrated on, you know, doing all those things. You know, I always trained legs. I was always into squats, always hamstrings, calves, everything else. I just made the whole package. The other guys were just, you know, they were half-assers. They went in and pumped their arms and their chest.
Yep.
And I also, you know, I was into exercise and the whole fitness thing holistically, you know, from a health perspective. I didn't eat the shit food. I didn't go out and hang out in bars and, you know, run with groupies and stuff like that. I mean, I was a bachelor. I did my fair share of whatever, you know, getting into whatever fun I wanted to. But I also was very self-disciplined, and I never gave that up. And that served me well. If you go back and look at my career from when I started to where in 96, when I went back for the last time in WWF, my physique just came better, the whole package. And it fit in with the character and the super hero just walked off the pages of a comic book type of thing, and that is money. And
why did you like what determines, or why did you stop wrestling? I didn't follow like the whole thing closely, but why did you stop wrestling, and why do wrestlers in general, like, what determines when that's it, when the time is over? And
Well, I got to a place after I achieved, you know, the highest level success you could,
yep.
where once you get to that place, you have a really firm grasp on what your character is. At that point, two things become more important. Sustaining the image that you're created, like with the other guys that you work with, like other guys that say you're going to work a program with back at the time, you know, the good guy versus bad guy thing.
Right.
You would have, they bring bad guys in for you to work with, and they had this idea about what they were going to get away with inside the ring to suit their needs. But if you're a powerful good guy babyface, it's your responsibility. And you've reached the top. It's your responsibility to say, well, hold on a second. For instance, just to give you a simple example, let's say I'm working with a bad guy, and he makes a suggestion, you know, I'm gonna nail you, you take a bump, meaning, you know, I go down, like his punch fucking knocked me down. Well, I had created Ultimate Warrior in a way where, no, it takes more than one punch to knock Ultimate Warrior down. And so you sort of enter into a negotiation, or you make it clear to them, depending on, you know, what place they have in the company, well, that's not going to work for me. I mean, Andre the Giant let me put him in a bear hug and acted like, and he squealed like a pig, you know? I mean, I could barely get my arms around him. But the point is that it's all that stuff is done to create an image of something. So people believe in it while they're in the arenas. And so I ended up at, and then the other thing, holding on, sustaining what you've created, your characters, what your character is one thing. The other thing is the business part of it. Then it becomes really interesting. And me and Vince butted heads, and we had several fallouts, and had a couple lawsuits and everything else, and by the time we got through all that stuff, I was just at the place where, you know, it just doesn't work for me anymore.
Right. How old were you when that's it, when you said, that's it, I'm done?
Well, when I went back in 96, I was almost 40. And I think I looked better than I ever looked in my whole life. Everything. I mean, of course, I invested incredibly in costumes and gear and everything. I mean, I carried a notebook around with me all the time. I was totally absorbed in it. You know, about success. I mean, your whole thing is about success, helping people become successful about what they want to do, being fucking passionate about something. you have to become totally absorbed by it. And my whole world was Ultimate Warrior. I mean, when I went to the ring, man, I became that motherfucker.
Right, that's what I'm saying. I when I look at your videos now, I'm like, man, I don't, that was not, there was like no way that was an act, that was you. And I, when I see that, I was like, man, I remember when I used to like train, you know, that switch just flips on, but that's who I really was. And that's who I would have rather have been, you know, 24/7. I remember like when you going into that ring, like sprinting and always like pulling on the ropes. And now, you know, older and just understanding and seeing who you are, I'm like, man, that wasn't an act. That was him just being fucking fired up to be where he was and to be who he is.
Yeah, well, the characters back then, today it's a totally different game because they've got, you know, a staff of a creative staff, writers. They script what the guys are going to say. They hold their hands and what kind of characters they're going to be. They plug them into a template that they think fits, you know, they get raw talent, and then they just bring them in, they plug them in. Back at that time, whatever a character was in the ring was just an amped up version of who that guy was outside the ring. The guys who are cocky and arrogant and walked with the swagger, outside the ring, they did the same shit on the street. But all they did was they amplify it in the ring. And I, you know, from the day I picked up a weight, it was all or nothing, man. And, you know, it wasn't about, I mean, I go into gyms, you see the guys who just, their breathing is totally, absolutely controlled. They never, there's no exertion of anything, any emotion or anything that comes out of them at all. And that just never worked for me. And I, being explosive, being fucking intense, I mean, that's what makes me feel alive about everything. And I, you know... Me and you talked about it the other time when we talked before that I can't emphasize enough as a man, especially the young guys, that you need to fucking establish now a stout discipline in that you can go to that place, man, because there comes a point in time where you reach an age where your body starts sending messages to itself on the inside that it's time to shut the machine down. And if you're not ready to stand up and start fighting back, fuck. You become a vagina man.
It's so true. I have ran into people that I've been to high school with here and there or college, and it just ages them. I look at them,
yeah,
and I'm like, holy shit. Even not just the men, but even the women, they just fucking let it go. Like they said, that's it. I'm no longer.
They're not fighting back anymore at all. They've given in to it. They've surrendered. You can't do that.
Who told
because
you?
Because you're going to spend the next 30 or 40 years suffering because you have. And
they give in. They just cave in to. It's just so hard. I can't really relate to it. But I know that I learned that from wrestling, and I remember like all the little things like my coaches said to me and just the things we endured in practice. And you know, you were a football player in high school. Did you wrestle in high school? Or
I played 1 year of football. I was a skinny kid, but boy, I can dig deep, man. I was intense. I was so skinny. And I was the kid that was in the wrong place at the wrong time, not for serious stuff because there wasn't serious stuff to get into.
Right.
But I made buddies with a farming kid. I told you where I lived was rural, and everybody,
yeah,
they either drove to the next bigger cities over and worked in factories, their parents did, or they were farmers. And I struck up a really good friendship with a kid by the name of Dan Pyle, who had come from a farming family. His dad was a big, huge farmer. They farmed like tens of thousands of acres, and he was always just working on the farm ever since,
yep,
he was a little kid. And I worked with him one summer on the farm, and when it came time to go sign up for football, he said, you should do it, you know. And he wasn't mocking me or, you know, being funny with me or trying to push my buttons. He was serious. He said he just was mature beyond his actual age, and he thought to himself, this would be a good thing for, you know, my friend. And so I did it. I went and signed up for it. I'd already had been into the weight training thing for a while, but I was still skinny as hell. And I went out there and I gave it my all, but by the end of the football season, and they put me down in those drills where you get head up with somebody,
sure, yeah.
You know, and you got a line that the drill only ends when somebody gets pushed back such certain distance.
Right.
They couldn't get me to where they wanted me to go, you know, to get the full blown laugh out of what they were trying to do, because I would just get angry on the inside and stand my ground, even if I made no headway against them. And by the end of the first football season, I was addicted to the weight training. I bought an easy curl bar. I mean, you can go buy everything today.
Right.
And the principal, we had a principal, and he, you know, was one of those guys that you find a lot of, guys you find a lot of in your life when you are one of those people that wants to be the best at something. One of these guys who was jealous and envious of me spending time in the weight room. So he came up with a rule, even though there wasn't one, that I couldn't be in there unsupervised. And so I had, back then, this really going by, 8-track tapes, that's what people played.
Yeah.
I had a little 8-track tape player with Ted Nugent, Cat Scratch Fever. He would lock me. I'd stay in that weight room, but as long as I could, he'd come lock me out. I'd stand outside the door with my easy curl bar and my Cat Scratch Fever on and do curls for like a couple hours. Just
that's
to
great.
Piss him off.
I love listening to those old tunes. Last night, I actually went to a wrestling match to watch one of my kids wrestle, and it was in a, you know, this town's a blue-collar town, and one of the coaches is a former Marine, and they came out to John Fogerty, Fortunate Son, and it was fucking awesome, and the place was fucking packed, and they were competing against the team down by my area, which is an hour away, and both teams are top teams, and man, the place was going nuts. I threw it on YouTube, but I was like, oh man, like all these teams nowadays go out to some sort of like rap or something. I was like, oh, that fucking Marine coach probably.
No
said,
way,
yeah.
Man. I don't know music well enough where I can, if I hear a song and I like it,
yeah.
And I don't know the band, I don't know the name of the song, but man, yeah, and the thing is, when you play that kind of stuff, everybody gets the same, the same emotional thing happens to them. And it's another point, and I saw your buddy Jason, how do you pronounce his last name?
Faruja?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the music thing.
Yeah.
And those guys, about, you know, you've got to find ways to summon that stuff up in yourself, man, until it becomes a habit. And music is a great way to do that. Yeah, I don't understand any of the music that's out there today.
What do you listen to? I see that when you do your video, sometimes you got your headphones.
Just a variety of stuff. And like I say, I can't even, you know, I don't even know. Some of the popular stuff,
right.
Nickelback, I like the ballad stuff from when I used to grow up.
Yep.
Five Finger, what, Death Punch or
yeah.
Punch or something?
Yeah.
That kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Dead Letter Circus, I like to listen to them. Dream Theater.
Dream Theater, yeah, that is old school. Jim Wendler would be proud.
Yeah, I like everything, man.
Yeah. And
I like something that just gets me in a place where, yeah, fuck
yeah.
It, man.
Yeah,
let's go for it.
Go for it. And where are you is that when we see some of your videos, I see like a leg extension in the back. You have a gym set up in a... Like,
yeah, I have a barn on my property, man.
Right.
It's an old barn. And my studio is right behind there where I work on my art and handle the rest of my business stuff. And I owned a gym years ago in the mid-90s. And
what did you call that gym,
Arizona, man. It was tricked out. I had a lot of equipment. I put it in storage for years. And just this past year, the storage company needed to make some changes, so I moved on getting rid of it. I ended up selling most of it to a bodybuilder kid by the name of Brent Swanson up in Ohio.
I know that name, Swanson. Yeah.
Yeah, nice kid. Big old thing. When he came out to meet me to see it, you know, and he just got that big sickness to him, you know, up in the yoke and, brought back a lot of memories, you know, being that age and having that kind of volume. It was unreal, but it's a super nice kid. But I took a big truckload of it and brought basically you know, free weights and stuff and bars and a power rack. I don't, and the dumbbells and stuff. The other stuff I don't really much use. I have it. My wife likes to use some of that stuff. Got a leg press, got a rear delt machine. I've got a assisted dip chin machine because I just, you know, we talked about it the other day. I can't really do the chins, but I like to do the chins, so I use that for that. But otherwise, I just do the basics, man, the squats and the deadlifts, the military presses. It's what I've just continued to do for the years, just the basic grunt stuff. I mean, even if sometimes I just come in and I just pick one exercise and just keep doing it.
Yeah. What, when you were on the cover of the Super High Intensity, did they put you on the cover because you were a hit guy and you followed Arthur Jones and all that, or?
No, Chris Lund just, I wrote a post about it.
Yeah.
When I, you know, I got stacks and books and stuff. I got Ironmans and all those strength and health magazines going way back too. I'm a collector of all that stuff. And, just in one of those periods where I was consistently putting stuff up at my website and telling stories and stuff, I put that up there and I told the story. When I was out there, Ed Connors had set up for me to do a photo shoot with Chris Lund, and he says, you know, you're one of the only guys where I don't have to spray down or tell them to grimace. The fucking intensity is real.
Right.
And when I did the photo shoot, it wasn't to be put on the cover. I think that what happened was that Chris Lund was involved with Ellington Darden at the time, and they were doing the book, and Ellington was looking for pictures, and I got something from Ed or directly from Chris, said, you know, they want to know if you'd be okay with being put on the cover of this book and using a couple pictures of you inside. And I said, hell yeah.
Yeah.
But that was the reason.
I'm bummed. I actually, do you remember that show American Muscle Magazine?
I think I do.
Yeah, it would be 1 hour on ESPN. I used to watch it when I was in high school, and I got into high school in '89, and I remember it would be on during like odd times. It would be on during the day when I was at school, or it would be on at 3-4 in the morning. So I would cut school so I could record it, and I had recorded every episode from like the summer before high school, man, through years of even being into college. And then I remember when I don't remember really what happened, but I started really feeling just connected with my own style of training. I knew that the articles in the magazines were fabricated because I would collect them. And I remember I'd have Flex magazine from like 89, then I'd get one in 94, and it was the same article, but it was tweaked,
right,
and given a different author. So let's say they said it was Vic Richards, and then
next
time, 5 years later, they say it was Bertel Fox. And I remember I wrote a letter to the Weider offices, and I said, you fucking pussies, I dare you to...
Oh,
I dare,
right on, man!
I said, I dare you to post this in your magazine. I know that you're fucking lying to me. And I'll never forget that. I told my friend that I did at the time. He's like, holy shit, you're fucking nuts. I was like, no, man, they're lying to us. And that's what I was like.
That's awesome, man, that you took the time to do that. Yeah, I tell people, like with the magazines and stuff, I say, look, if you can't keep yourself from buying that stuff, buy 12 issues. You know, put them in nice little covers and bind them together or whatever like that. But I said, recognize that next year they're just going to regurgitate the same thing and put, you know, attribute the programs and the supplementation programs to being used by other people. And, you know, look, that's, I told you about that. And, you know, when we talked before, that's why I'm conflicted on the inside sometimes about that, because, and your response to me was good, that, you know, I felt a little conflicted because it's simple about what to do. It's not easy. It's hard, but it's simple. And I feel a little like I'm taking advantage when I tell people about, give them advice about that more than one time, you know, or more than the simple parts that they need to have to go and do it. And you said to me, well, what if we don't, you know, say anything at all? So, you know, that makes sense. Like, I have a start kit. It's called the Warrior Workout Start Kit.
Right.
And it's a program. It's an audio of me for 75 minutes. It's a written essay in there, sample diet and, you know, direction about what you need to eat and stuff. But basically what it is, it just, it focuses entirely on the fact that if you want it done, you're going to have to do it,
yep.
Period. That's it. That's all I have to offer. I don't even offer a workout program with it. You know, everybody knows what to do. You know, they, whether or not exercise works, healthy eating works, or what exactly it takes to build your physique, get stronger, whatever, it's out. The science is out. You know, the instruction is out. It's not secret. And you're going to have to, you know, when you talk about self-motivation, at some point in time, it involves the self. And a lot of people get it. It's $150, but they spend so much money on other things. A lot of people get it, and I offer with it a phone call with me,
right,
which is worth $150 alone. And I promote it for 10 minutes, and I usually don't stay on. I usually end up staying on the phone for at least 45 minutes or an hour, because I want them to get everything they need to get out of me to go out and make it happen. But a lot of people never contact me again, and they get pissed off. But because they act like the actual work it will take needed to be included in the package.
Yeah, it's interesting. There, I carry e-books, and what's very interesting is that there's a certain company that will sell your e-book.
It's funny, man. You've become like Joe Weider.
I don't know if I'll ever get to that level. But
you need to write a letter to yourself, man.
Oh my God. I'm not sure what I would tell myself. I'd probably tell, you know what,
hey,
I would
that,
tell myself.
That's not the important thing. What would you tell your wife and kids when no more money came in?
I think what would be, if I wrote a letter to myself, it would be to just continue to not follow and to just continue doing what I do, and probably to actually be more outspoken of, like, my true feelings. I see how people get upset if I say, you know, the pussification of America, or if I say fuck or things like that. But, you know, the truth be told is that, you know, I do, you know, I even say it in the blog. I say, look, you know, deep down, I was never the toughest guy. I was the biggest pussy, and I had to fight to, like, learn, and just going through wrestling, what it taught me, I just think people need to go through much harder. They need to test themselves mentally and physically more. And when we sell these ebooks through this certain company, they want you to offer a 60-day money-back guarantee. And it's always funny that when somebody, the refunds never come in unless it's through this one company, and it's always the program didn't work for me. And deep down, I don't waste my time, and I just forward it to my assistant. But deep down, I want to say, if I fucking just told you to squat every day, that would work. Anything would work. The reason why something isn't working is because you're being a fucking pussy. That's the goddamn bottom line. And you're right. And one of my best programs came when I stopped training at gyms. I just needed to be in an intense environment. And all that shit just disappeared. All the gyms were, you know, trying to go the fitness route, and nobody played loud music, and everybody was afraid of intensity. So I bought a 300-pound barbell set from Costco. I bought a pair of 50 and 100-pound dumbbells along with a flat utility bench out of a storage garage in Newark. A guy had a gym that shut down, so I got a dip bar, pair of 50 and hundreds, and then I bought a, it's called a gun rack, but it's just basically a set of squat stands, and I trained in the garage, and man, those fucking workouts were awesome, and I put on so much muscle, and on the weekend, I would go to a gym just so I could have heat, because this garage was colder than
my barn doesn't have any heating. When I had my gym in Arizona in the summertime, I didn't turn the air on.
Right, I never use air.
I mean, 110, 120 degrees.
Right. What about now, because you're out, it's like mountains kind of, right?
So, I'm in New Mexico out in the mountains.
It must get cold. Especially morning
It's down below freezing now. I mean, you can see your breath, you know, big clouds of breath.
So how
but
do
that's
you,
cool, man. I mean,
you love that.
Those are the kind of things that you need to subject yourself to. Look, when I was young, I always tell people when I was young, it's easy to jump on board for wild ideas, you know, and be full of piss and vinegar. But if you're a guy, especially guy, and I focus here on guys.
Yep.
You need to do things as you go on in your life to keep alive the courage it takes to take risk. And if you just always say no to them and you just always turn away from them and you lower your head and you walk with the caved in chest and you're not, you will become just pathetic. And, you know, when it's cold and it's miserable and if you want to succeed in life, what you have to be able to do is do the things you most don't want to do. And you've got to be able to, right then and there, in the rawest, most vicious way, of a controlled violence way, you need to turn on it and say, fuck that, man. And what I do is I use, even through my art and stuff, I use the heroic examples from history of what people have done and stepped up to. We're pathetic in so many ways today, including myself, including you, including all of us. You know, I take 2 showers a day. I get any kind of food I want. I walk to a refrigerator and grab it. I drink bottled water. I mean, fuck me. That's where I get kind of upset even with some of the guys out there that are the hardcore gurus. It's too much attention given to all this detailed stuff, you know? And I understand that they do it to do business, to operate a business, provide their way, and a lot of good comes out of it. But, you know, look, if your mind is the major factor, then it is all the time, not just part-time. You don't just give lip service to it. All this discussion about functionality and this and the foam rolling and all, yeah, okay, it may work. And if, you know, but just fucking turn the switch on in your mind and do what you need to do. I mean, you can take somebody through all that kind of specific type of functional training that you want. But if I got a guy who's got it right in the mind, he's going to kick that other guy's ass.
It's
all the time.
Mind of the War. Have you ever read that book, The Rogue Warrior by Dick Marcinko?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, he always would talk about in his training or when he was training the other Navy SEALs, he would talk about you don't have to like it, you just have to do it. I read that book. I had just turned 18, and I remember a guy recommended I read that. And I'll never forget those words. So that was half my lifetime ago. I remember reading that book. I was like, holy fuck, this guy is tough.
Oh, well, you should read some of the old stuff. Orison Sweet Marden, the guy who was the original founder of Success Magazine back in the late 1800s.
Yeah.
I mean, his art, you can get his books out there. You can find them at Alibris and Amazon.com has them. People sell them and stuff. Read his stuff. I mean, he makes people feel ashamed of themselves if they don't step up and do what they need to do to make their lives work.
I love that.
You know, and it's just, that's where I go for my inspiration, that type of stuff. And you can develop the habit. You can develop any habit, make anything a habit. You can develop the habit where you just don't put up with that inner dialogue where you've got some, you know, the wuss in you is talking you out of doing what you need to do as a man.
What do you do when, do you ever get that when you're like, I don't want to do something? Do you ever get that? Does that happen?
Not very much anymore.
Why?
If I have the thought, the whole thought doesn't come out of my mind before I get pissed off.
Gotcha.
And I just smash it right in the face.
But doing what? So what's...
just fucking saying, nope, that's intolerable. I'm not going to tolerate that shit. Get out of here. I'll get up. I'll just, you know, basically figuratively, maybe even literally, pound my chest. I go to the, you know, what I call the effort zone. You know, and if I've had a full day, 16 hours doing what I need to do to operate my business, make my life work, and in the morning I said to myself I was going to get in the gym, but it just didn't turn out that way that I could. It's cold. It's dark outside. got a couple light bulbs hanging from the ceiling, and I walk through my studio door into my gym. If it starts to seep into my mind that I can't do it, I said, the fuck, I can't do it. And I, you know, people spend too much time deliberating. You know, just drop. Just drop. Just do it. I mean, don't give yourself an opportunity to talk yourself out of it. If I'm, let's say I've got my regular street clothes on, or I've been out to a couple meetings or something like that, and I'm in my office, I'm finishing up some business, it's late, it's one of those days, I didn't get my workout in yet, I'll make myself go right over to the squat rack and just start squatting in my street clothes.
I'll lay down
on the ground and I'll start doing my sit-ups. And all it takes is 1 or 2 minutes before, man, I'm ready. Yeah. Let's go. Let's jack this thing up.
Arnold spoke about that. Like, he spoke about, you know, sometimes you show up to the gym and
I have my best workouts when I feel like I don't want to do it.
Yeah, because when you start getting that connection, he called it the dial tone. I can't remember. I think it was in his Education of a Bodybuilder or the Encyclopedia, but I read Education of a Bodybuilder every day from like.
Yeah, well, you know, Arnold should go back and read it. And while he's doing that, he should call his physician and see if he can get a shot at test.
Shocking to see he just let it go. I'm really shocked.
That's where he got fucked, man. That's where he got fucked. You know, these kind of things, that, like what he did.